This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, what lessons can today's Black activists learn from the Black Panther Party? The author of a new book has some answers. And it's the second week of the national prison strike. We'll speak to some activists in the Prisoners Support Network, and we'll discuss the role of cell phones in bringing public attention to massive human rights violations behind prison walls.
But first, President Trump had to call off his planned military parade on Veterans Day, which means anti-war groups don't have to hold counter-demonstration on the streets of Washington. But peace activists do plan a number of activities this autumn. Jamu Baraka is executive director of the Black Alliance for Peace. He explains how Trump's parade got canceled.
I think that it was quite clear that they're already feeling the pressure from various sectors of the population in opposition to this gratuitous demonstration of militarism represented by the Trump parade. But I think that the nail in the coffin, if you will, was when the Washington City Council and administration and the Pentagon indicated that there was a revived cost for the parade, which was $92 million. So they decided to postpone, which is a good thing. But again, it was quite clear that there was significant opposition generating. The coalition that we pulled together to oppose the parade, just in a matter of about 10 days, was able to almost triple the number of organizations in opposition to the parade. And we were communicating with the administration and with elements in the Republican and the Democratic Party that there was going to be significant opposition if that parade, in fact, happened. So I think that they took the wise decision and postponed. Now the objective is to make sure that that ideal never sees the light of day again.
And of course, peace forces are still going to have some events that would have been hooked to the parade. That's not going to happen, but the peace events will still go on.
It will. We are characterizing this fall as the anti-war autumn. There are a number of activities being organized to try to raise the visibility of this issue of war and continued U.S. militarism. So even though the parade on that weekend has been canceled, we're going forward with organizing a peace conference, if you will, or it's Peace and Social Justice Conference. We're still working out the title. And those forces that come to that conference on that Saturday will be encouraged to support efforts by the veterans and others who are going to be marching on that Sunday. So those activities that weekend will continue, along with activities that the Black Alliance for Peace is organizing on October the 1st, the 10th anniversary of the U.S. African Command. We are launching our official campaign to oppose AFRICOM and calling for the U.S. to withdraw its forces from the African continent. A number of other organizations, anti-war organizations, are organizing various activities, again, during the fall, again, with the objective to try to put on notice that there is a reviving anti-war movement and calling on these various so-called progressive politicians to take a clear and definitive position on the issue of war and U.S. militarism. Either you're going to be for it, or you're going to be opposed to it, but you cannot be allowed to be silent on this issue.
The Black Alliance for Peace is also part of the Women's March against the Pentagon that's coming up.
Exactly. We are supporting that march. We think it's a very important event. We in particular like the idea that it is led and organized by women who are, by their very presence, raising the issue of the disproportionality of the negative impact of militarism on women and on children. We think it's important that the Pentagon is, in fact, the target, and it is going to be a very important part of this anti-war autumn. And it's coming at a time, third week in October, that it will be one of the events that we hope will help to put on notice these politicians who are running for office, in particular these folks who are part of the so-called Democrat Blue Wave, that we're not going to stand by and allow for them to attempt to get themselves elected without clearly stating where they stand on U.S. militarism. And we know, because, you know, Barr has been one of the major sources covering this issue, that the Democratic Party and their attempt to try to shore up the center and their center right elements, they've gone out and basically recruited individuals from the military and intelligence agencies, ex-officials. And a number of these people who are part of the so-called Blue Wave are individuals from those two sectors who appear to not be opposed to U.S. militarism, in fact, to be quite comfortable with that. We're not going to allow that to stand. We're not going to allow for the Democratic Party to continue to pretend on one hand to be a party in alignment with the needs and interests of the working class, and on the other, to support U.S. militarism and war that has a disproportionate negative impact on working class, on poor people in this country and globally.
Yes, U.S. militarism, whether in Africa or any place else, doesn't seem to be an issue either with the establishment Democrats or with Bernie's various outfits.
No, it isn't. And we are very adamant in making the connection between not only our opposition to militarism and war abroad, but the war being waged against Black and poor people and working class people in this country. So that link is a link that we believe has to be established. People have to understand that link. And again, by establishing that link, we hope to make sure that these politicians who are trying to mobilize Black political support are not allowed to avoid making definitive statements, taking definitive positions on this issue of war and peace, and the war being waged against Black and brown and working class people in this country. So these kinds of political links, these kinds of issues have to become part of the discourse here this fall, because if not, then we're going to see ourselves in a situation where the Trump administration, along with their Democratic allies who are in support of the permanent war agenda, are going to be able to continue the process of normalizing war and militarism. And we cannot allow that to happen, not only because of the impact it has on us, but because of our responsibility to people globally. We're here in the middle of empire. It is immoral if we are not taking definitive positions in opposition to the policies and practices of this state that's responsible for the death and destruction, destabilization of nations and peoples around the world.
Yes, and this death and destruction doesn't come solely from kinetic weapons like bombs and such, but also from the destructive power of sanctions of the dollar.
Exactly, and we have to broaden out our understanding of what we mean by war and militarism and intervention, understanding that there are different aspects of war. And we see that the U.S. has been engaged in economic war against a number of nations for quite some time. We know that the consequence of the economic war on Venezuela has been devastating. We know that the economic war waged in the form of sanctions and boycotts against Cuba is now in its, or going on its sixth decade. So the weapon of economic war, of sanctions and boycotts, we need to understand that this is an aspect of war, and it is one in which the ruling elite is going to utilize even more as we go forward because of the relative decline of the U.S. within the array of nations and the capitalist order, and the fact that the rules and regulations governing how nations are related to one another economically has basically been jettisoned and is now straight up gangsterism. So the sanctions on the Russian defense industry has nothing to do with their concerns about Russian allegations about the U.S. elections. It's about carving out and protecting the U.S. defense industry against their number one rival. So it's all about economic gangsterism. We've got to understand that.
And when we're talking about black folks and how black people internationally are affected by U.S. militarism, Venezuela is part of that conversation because there is a definite racial aspect to Venezuelan liberation and U.S. resistance to that liberation.
Exactly. Not only do we have a significant population of black people in Venezuela, but our concern with Venezuela is not only because of that element, but because we understand the role that Venezuela plays for the progressive and liberation process throughout the Americas. We have always understood that the Venezuelan process was going to be in the crosshairs of U.S. destabilization because the U.S. policymakers understood that if you weaken Venezuela, then you weaken and undermine the entire progressive and radical movements throughout the Americas. So we stand in solidarity with Venezuela. We recognize the economic war being waged on them and the potential military war with the encouragement by the U.S. administration with nations like Colombia to put itself on a military footing vis-a-vis Venezuela, along with the right-wing government that's been installed in Brazil. So, you know, militarism along with these economic war elements is making the situation throughout Latin America much more dangerous. And let's not leave out what is happening in Haiti, because Haiti is key for the entire region, in particular the region of the Caribbean. And we know that we still have an occupation force in Haiti. And we know that there's still other intelligence agencies operating in Haiti to make sure that the political opposition is not able to galvanize itself in that country. So we are seeing in Haiti, throughout Latin America, on the African continent, the move toward using coercion, aggression, and direct military intervention to shore up and to advance the interests of the colonial capitalist system.
That was Jamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka was also the 2016 Green Party candidate for vice president, and he's an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
Robin Spencer is the author of a new book on the Black Panther Party for self-defense. It's titled, The Revolution Has Come. Spencer thinks today's anti-police violence activists could learn valuable lessons from the Panthers, who began as a kind of cop watch organization in Oakland, California.
I do believe that because the Panthers saw monitoring the police as part of a larger political platform, that the cop watch programs of today really need to take a more comprehensive approach. Now, I'm not very familiar with those programs, especially in their local iterations, and they have proliferated due to the realities of police violence. However, for the Panthers, monitoring the police was part of a larger political program. So after they monitored the police, part of what they did was use the spectacle and the political theater. And I'm not saying theater because it was lightly taken on cultural kind of event. I'm saying theater in the sense of the drama of it. I mean, some of these incidents and encounters with the police were life and death in the 1960s, just as we know any traffic stop today can be a life and death encounter in seconds. And the Panthers took that moment where they demonstrated to the community that they could, with the law on their side, stand up and speak out to the forces of the police they used those moments to educate. So they would oftentimes pass around their political platform and program. So I do think that any Cop Watch type organization today would benefit from that dual result in not only monitoring the police, but educating the community around them, around the larger meaning of police violence and the larger implications of what the community may see unfolding in front of them, the day-to-day encounters, but connecting those things to a larger structure and system of oppression. I mean, I think that's where the Panthers made their key intervention.
You pay particular attention to the contributions that women made to the movement in general, but to the Black Panther Party in particular. But those of us who were there also remember the term draws for the cause and what that indicated in terms of much of the political practice in the party, how women were seen as draws for the cause.
Agreed. I mean, I think about the phrase, women say yes to men who say no, which was a rallying cry for the anti-war movement. The idea of draws for the cause, unfortunately, was a widespread phenomenon all across the new left within the Black Power movement. Women found, however, that they could challenge those ideas with materials that they found in the organizational structure of the Black Panther Party. So yes, that mentality may have been there in the various organizations, but when women responded to that with male allies at their side, they oftentimes faced differing levels of reaction. So the Panthers definitely engaged in that kind of struggle. I'm not saying that when women and their allies may have stood up and said that they're more than draws for the cause, that the men fell back. I'm not saying that there weren't women who were down with that idea. I'm just saying that I think that within the context of the Black Panther Party, they were able to model and articulate an alternative for women's participation in the movement that was egalitarian, that gave women voice, and that allowed women to seize the space that they did in order to exercise leadership and to be in power and all of that. This was during the sexual revolution. The sexual history of Black power and this time period in general is not something that has really been analyzed in a very deep way, in a very scholarly way. So yes, there were definitely people experimenting with different types of sexual freedoms in this time period. And the idea of draws for the cause, I think for those reasons and others, may have resonated with some, but I can say that there were many, many women within the context of the Black Panther Party and some men who didn't see that as a slammed door in their faces, right? They saw it as a site of struggle that they engaged in out of a commitment to the larger goals of the organization.
The year 1969 was a kind of year of the long knives, culminating in the assassination of Fred Hampton in Chicago. That was the year that J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI vowed to crush the Panthers, and there were many arrests and assassinations that year. And the party also purged many of its chapters and closed chapters down that year in what looked to many of us like a retreat, but you believe that it was a more strategic kind of movement back to Oakland.
Right. It was really a retrenchment. Now, the reality was is that the Black Panther Party was an organization that was under siege. There was very little time for planning, for strategy in some ways. They operated on the go. You know, they were in motion, making revolution. So it doesn't mean that their ideas or actions were taken on lightly, but it does mean that they responded to the context they found themselves in. So now the idea of purging members and closing chapters was definitely a retrenchment, right? It meant that they were in some ways weakening their numbers, but they were also strengthening their forces. I think by this point, in their history that political repression had become such a corrosive force within the organization that purging chapters and members was seen as a viable option. They had an open door policy before, and lots of agents and provocateurs had walked through that open door. Lots of people who were not as willing to be politically educated, and the reality was that sometimes their political education was unevenly applied and in need of strengthening. So all of those factors, I think, led to where the Panthers found themselves in 1969. The move to Oakland was not until later, after Huey Newton was released from prison after the Free Huey campaign, when the FBI's attack on the Panthers really reached a fever pitch and precipitated internal violence within the organization.
What stands out most, or stands out most to many people, about the Panther Party was the uncompromising anti-imperialism of the party. Their anti-capitalism, their anti-imperialism, their willingness to make common cause with actual revolutionaries waging actual fights against U.S. imperialism around the world.
That is a untold story in the history of the Black Panther Party. Elbert Big Man Howard recently passed away. His travels all throughout the world on behalf of the Black Panther Party, the story of that needs to be told. There's a new film that's come out, Congo Oye, about the Panthers in Congo, Kinshasa, and the way that they went to frontline African liberation struggles and tried to enact solidarity. The story of the Panthers and their connections to the Palestinians has been written about in a few books, but there's still more to be said about their politics, of their anti-colonial politics in the period. And I think that the most important thing about the Black Panther Party is that they saw the world through this lens of global justice. So they were connecting themselves to the anti-apartheid movement, to anti-colonial struggles, to liberation struggles in Africa, especially in the former Portuguese colonies. And they saw that as part and parcel of the movement in the United States. It was not an add-on. It was not charity. It was not them being expansive in their view. For them, it was a matter of survival, because they saw their survival as wound up in the survival of these people seeking liberation in other parts of the world. I have not mentioned the Vietnamese and their anti-war stance at a time where the U.S. military machine was wreaking havoc in Vietnam. So the Panthers' anti-imperial stance is something that I wish more people knew about. In a lot of ways, it's a key element of their legacy. There's so many people and places to mention. We have people like Donald Cox, Barbara Cox, Kathleen Cleaver, Sekou Odinga, Charlotte Hill O'Neill. These are not just a litany of names, but each name is attached to places and experiences where Panthers went into the world and lived alongside other people waging revolution in their countries and connected themselves and learned from those movements, as well as shared whatever they knew or whatever they could about the movement here. And that's what needs to happen today. Solidarity is not just about individual connections or social media linkages. It's about literally informing oneself. The Panthers had an international section of their newspaper where they informed the community and themselves about what is going on in these countries. It put people on the same level in terms of education and knowledge, because that is also what solidarity is about, actually learning the facts about what is going on and stepping away from the diet of mainstream news to really understand what's happening in these countries and amongst these movements that are seeking liberation. So anyone who wants to be like a Panther or enact some of the greatest parts of their legacy should be thinking about those very real international connections and also reading, educating themselves. The Panthers were very strong on self-education, community education. And that part of their legacy is also less understood.
Well, actually, a lot of people around the world wanted to be like Panthers, and in lots of places, including India, set up parties that they called Black Panther parties. And now today, there are at least four parties in the United States that call themselves Panther.
There are. The legacy of the Black Panther Party has been pretty broad, and many have stepped into the archive of their struggle and tried to pull out useful lessons for today. I think it's important for anyone today, and I'm hoping that more and more people are seeing the need of being politically organized and joining political organizations, that they choose organizations not based on the name or the connection to a past, but based on what that particular organization has to offer to the movements, to the needs, to the struggles of today. And I think that is the litmus test. The Black Panther Party, I think, grew out of their time. They were inspired by the Black Panther Party that came out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and people like Kwame Ture and others who were engaged in that level of struggle. And they took the Panther name into their own direction. And I think today that is what is needed. There are definitely elements of the Panther's legacy which still speak to where we are in this contemporary moment. And there are also elements of the Panther's legacy that should not be replicated and that don't fit today. And I think that any organization who is operating in the Panther name should be thinking about the broad range of what they did. They were not just a militaristic organization. Armed self-defense was part of a larger platform and program. For better or for worse, they had a very rigid organizational structure. They were very top-down in many ways. They, in a lot of ways, tried to create a revolutionary vehicle. And that is what is needed today, a revolutionary vehicle. And I applaud anyone who takes the Panther name and tries to move the liberation movement in that direction, as long as they are speaking to the needs of the people and the community. The Panthers reflected those needs, and they also pushed past maybe what people even felt was possible at the time. And that's the kind of visionary leadership, that's the kind of multifaceted leadership that is needed today.
That was Robin Spencer, author of The Revolution Has Come and an associate professor of history at Lehman College in New York City.
Inmates at a number of prisons across the country are on strike. They describe the mass incarceration system as slavery by another name. In recent years, prison officials have gone apoplectic over inmates' access to cell phones. We spoke with Nance Gol-Ganoush, senior research analyst at the Citizen Project in Washington, D.C.
Yes, my understanding is that a lot of correctional leaders around the country are really struggling to control the proliferation of cell phones in prisons. And I think that for them, cell phones are a problem for a couple of reasons. One of them I see as legitimate. They have a harder time monitoring cell phone use and the conversations that take place. And so then they worry that the conversations that happen there and potential disputes over cell phones can result in crimes outside of prisons and violence within. And I can understand, and I think there's some basis to that concern. But there are other concerns as well, such as the worry that states are not going to be collecting revenues as they had been from people using the collect call system that states have put in place, where they, in many, many parts of the country, correctional systems are able to take a cut of the very high cost that comes with those calls. And so in some sense, there's a lost revenue, even though many states have begun to implement reforms to reduce the excessively high costs of phone calls. The other issue is that the proliferation of cell phones in prisons demonstrates in some ways the corruption of some guards that work in these institutions, because in many places, guards are getting arrested for bringing phones in. In California, for example, there was an analysis done by the California Senate Committee on Public Safety that found that guards and staff at prisons were the primary source for contraband cell phones. So I think these are all reasons, you know, some legitimate, some not, that correctional institutions are worried about the use of cell phones, contraband cell phones in prisons.
Yes, cell phones are not easily stuffed into bodily orifices and gotten into prison that way. And it's almost universally accepted among prisoners that the guards are the root of the cell phone trade. But isn't there an even more fundamental problem that the state has with cell phones? That when prisoners are able to make contact with the outside world almost at leisure and maintain that contact, then the prison environment as an island of control has been invaded, so to speak.
Yes, and that happens in two ways. That happens first when people in prison are able to contact reporters and public figures that are able to then broadcast the messages that they're sending and the images and videos that they're sharing that they were able to capture from their cell phones that help to sort of pull the curtain on what's happening in these institutions, which are located far from urban areas, are difficult to access for reporters. So we have a very hard time getting a sense of what's going on in prisons, what kind of problems people are facing when they're held in these facilities. So in that sense, it allows people that are incarcerated to serve as reporters and witnesses and help to really broadcast firsthand what they're experiencing behind bars. The other issue is that these phones help to connect people to their loved ones outside of prison. So this is something that correctional institutions, as institutions that purportedly want to promote rehabilitation, should be supporting. The connection that incarcerated people are trying to maintain with people that are not behind bars, with family members, with mothers, with wives, with girlfriends, with children. You know, this is, I would guess, that overwhelmingly what's happening in these cell phone connections that people have are these kinds of conversations, and that's what I saw in California. I found that people that were middle-aged, living their lives, working their jobs, doing their best to support their families and help their incarcerated loved one stay connected and do the things that he often had to do in order to qualify for release, they would be connected to these people through cell phones because it was too expensive to call them through the sanctioned phone service. It was also difficult to just talk to them through these, even if they could afford it. It was difficult for the incarcerated individual to have enough time to be able to make these phone calls because the duration of the conversation is often very limited, like 15-minute intervals. And so if they talk by phone, they could talk for a longer period of time. They could share pictures. They could communicate by video. All of the things that we do on a regular basis in 2018 that most incarcerated people are blocked from doing. And these things help to these incarcerated individuals to stay connected, to have people on the outside telling them, I know you got into a fight, but if you retaliate, I'm going to be very upset with you about that. And so then they would take that into consideration when thinking about how to behave while incarcerated. They would receive access, they would get connected to rehabilitative programs and educational programs that they could participate in remotely because of the dearth of these kinds of programs within correctional institutions. These are all very important kinds of services that family members and loved ones are doing for incarcerated people using cell phones. And that's something that really gets very little media attention in terms of what is the most common usage of these phones. There's no denying that sometimes these phones are used in harmful ways, but we need to also recognize what the very healthy use of them is about and how we can promote those kinds of connections in ways that correctional institutions are not interfering with and actually are not punishing.
Yes, a very small, minute proportion of phones might be used by gangs planning retribution attacks on other folks on the outside. But most prisoners would like to make the same kind of calls they made before they were in, the same kind of calls that most of us make every day to people who are close.
Right, that's exactly right. And so the article that I wrote was based on dissertation research that I did when I was living in California. And so when I would talk to incarcerated people that were serving life sentences that were using these phones, there was a lot at stake for them. If they were caught using these phones, they would end up often being denied parole as a result of being caught using a contraband phone. But when I asked them what they did with these phones, so often it was about making a connection with a girlfriend, staying connected and repairing relationships that were harmed from the fact that of the crime that they committed, from how long that they were away. This is often overlooked. And so the factors that I mentioned before, the overcrowding in prisons that makes it so that people have very limited access to phones, the very high cost of the phones, these are all issues. But another really important issue I think to think about when we think about cell phone use and contraband cell phone use in prisons is that so many people are in prison and so many are serving such long sentences. Many people should not be there at all so that they don't have to face these options of how to stay connected with their loved ones. They should be back home in their communities. But given that we've sent them away and we're keeping them away for so long, we need to think about, just like the people that are participating in the prison strike have called attention to, why is there a lack of rehabilitative services available to them? Why are we sending people away for life without the possibility of parole? So many people serving that sentence, so that if they want to stay connected, these are the kinds of options that they face in order to make connections to people outside of prison. So I think that sentencing and the fact that so many people are in prison and serving such long sentences is a sort of a critical underlying issue here that we need to think about.
And now we have the prison strike, which supposedly is going on in 17 states. Any information we might get would be via those contraband cell phones.
Right. And, you know, just earlier when we had the violence at Leak Correctional Facility in South Carolina, Heather Ann Thompson wrote an op-ed in the New York Times describing the kinds of accounts that she was hearing from people behind bars about what was going on and what had happened prior to that incident and during that riot and the reaction and the limited reaction and response from the guards to help to prevent that situation from getting as violent and volatile as it did. And so it's thanks to these phones, which again, I recognize that they can also be harmful, but it's thanks to these phones that we're able to get access to incarcerated people to hear what's happening, because otherwise what would happen is that many reporters will end up relying on correctional agencies for accounts of what's happening, and they're not in a position to necessarily provide the most complete account of what's going on behind bars, what the concerns are, what the deficiencies are in the services that they're providing, what the problems are in the food services that they've contracted out to provide to incarcerated people, why guards are reluctant to stop violence from ballooning out of control when it happens. There's an institutional incentive to present a positive picture of the correctional system itself, but it's from people that are incarcerated that have access to these phones that we've been able to hear some of the truths that had been hidden previously, like the problems with food, like the reluctance of guards to prevent violence from breaking out. These kinds of stories we owe to the proliferation of contraband cell phones.
And what kind of recommendations would you have for limited or somewhat regulated use of cell phones behind the bars?
Well, again, my first recommendation is that we reconsider how many people are behind bars, that this isn't even an issue that we need to sort of weigh. So there's the need to reevaluate how many people are being sentenced to prison terms and how long they're being kept there. Second, if we want to get people away from cell phones and using the regular phones, if we reduce overcrowding, then we can increase access to the collect call systems that states have in place. And we also need to make sure that the cost of those calls is no more than it needs to be. So, for example, New York City has implemented reforms in its jails to allow people to make calls for free home. And that's something that needs to happen. You know, a lot of states have really reduced their reliance on cutbacks from private phone vendors that take a profit for themselves and provide a kickback to states. So that practice has started to phase out, but there's still a lot more work to do to make it so that we're not extracting these excessive fees from some of the people that are least able to pay for it. So I think those are really two critical reforms that need to happen. Reducing the financial burden from using the sanctioned phone services and just reducing the overcrowding and excessive levels of incarceration that we have.
So you really don't have recommendations on regulating or limited use of cell phones in prisons, but just to reduce overcrowding and other conditions in behind the bars.
Those are my main recommendations. I think there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done about what to do with, you know, can incarcerated people use cell phones? Is there a need to monitor all of these calls? Is that possible? Technologically, one would think that that should be possible. What I know is that the efforts from many states right now to charge criminal penalties on people if they use cell phones, what that ends up doing is that it just increases already long prison sentences for people. States have also tried to block cell phone signals from going in, from accessing prisons. And that's something that, as far as I can tell, a lot of incarcerated people are able to work around. So I think that one of the worst responses is to increase criminal penalties for incarcerated people that are using cell phones, given that there are so many of these phones in many correctional institutions and the most common use is so innocuous. But in terms of how can we get to the point where I don't have any clear plan to propose about how incarcerated people can just use sanctioned cell phones. Maybe that's a possibility. That would be, I think, maybe the best outcome in terms of being able to give people the kinds of technology that's available, you know, that the rest of the world has adapted to and many people are blocked from using if they're incarcerated. But I do recognize that there are safety concerns about that that would need to be addressed.
The Trump administration came in with a different verbal attitude from its predecessor. The Obama administration paid lip service, at least, to prison reforms. And, of course, the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions is totally law and order, if you listen to their words. But how has that impacted on the ground or on the prison yard?
Well, as far as policy reforms, there's still a lot happening at the state level. So a number of states have significantly reduced their prison populations in recent years. So New York, New Jersey, California are among states that have reduced their prison populations by over 25%. And they really serve as models for other states to be able to follow and have shown that you can make those kinds of reductions in your prison population without harming crime rates. So those states have actually, by many measures, outpaced the nationwide crime rate during the time that they've reduced their prison populations. At the federal level, there have been a number of sentencing reform proposals that judiciary committees in the House and the Senate have approved, but they have not yet come up for a vote in order for Congress to decide whether or not we can reduce federal sentences for people that are serving time in federal prisons. And it's something that Trump has, during his campaign and afterward, we've not heard good messaging from him, including, you know, his calls for implementing the death penalty against people that are selling drugs. I mean, that's about a step as far back as we could imagine. And Jeff Sessions has also, while he was a senator, was one of the staunchest opponents of sentencing reform, and now here he is as Attorney General. On the other hand, despite these words that we're hearing and some of these policies, we can see that still the federal prison population has been declining during the time that Trump has been in office, and that's in part thanks to the ongoing impact of the reforms that the Obama administration implemented and that were implemented by the Sentencing Commission during the time that he was in office. So when you look at the actual numbers of people serving prison sentences in the federal system and in states across the country, we're still in the range percentage of, you know, seeing the effects of modest reforms. The numbers are still going down. And Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, has some interest and commitment to reforming federal prison sentences and reducing excessive prison terms. So potentially the latest that we're hearing is that the Congress may consider this after the midterm elections. So we've been waiting for a long time, and hopefully some of the people that are around the president will be able to persuade him that this is a policy reform that many people support, and that at least this is one area that he can do some good on.
That was Nazgul Ghanouch of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C.
The national prison strike has been underway since August 21st and continues through September 9th. The Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee is part of the inmate support network outside the prison walls. Bruce Terpstra is an activist with the committee. He put the prisoners' strike in historical perspective.
Well, the strike is another chapter in the prisoners' movement. An independent and self-organizing, self-determined movement from inside prisons that essentially dates back to the work stoppages in Georgia in 2010. It all depends on what lens we want to throw on the struggle. We can view it either in that respect or in terms of the 20th century and industrialized dehumanization and mass incarceration, or we could also view it in light of 500 years of indigenous and African struggle. The context in the immediate, we can date the present tactics and kind of media environment at least back to 2016 in the way that tactics have developed and enlarged to include not only work stoppages, but hunger strikes, boycotts, and sit-downs or lay-downs inside facilities, as well as the breadth of tactics undertaken on the outside in terms of media campaign, anti-repression work, legal representation, outreach, et cetera. Many of these lessons were learned in 2016 and are being applied now. In terms of the greater context, mass incarceration in the United States may have plateaued in its numbers, but the essential conditions of slavery continue. Essentially, the power relationship between the state and subject populations and their use of prisons as a tool of mass dehumanization and traumatization.
And when you and others use the term slavery, you're not just talking about the dehumanization of people.
Yes. In terms of one aspect of slavery is exploited labor, extraction of values, reducing a human being to a fungible, countable, collectible object, a commodity. The 13th Amendment, while purporting to abolish slavery, essentially nationalized it. It transferred ownership of black bodies of kidnapped Africans to the state and utilized the prison system in order to extract labor en masse, as well as discipline that whole community. The Convict Leasing Acts. Convict leasing started in 1844, but continued and flowered after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War under the 13th Amendment. Essentially, the whole relationship between the state, between the power structure, and diasporic kidnapped Africans simply was modified. It was not abolished or reconstructed.
So here we have about 2 million people who are restricted in every way that the state, a rich state, can apply. How difficult then has this strike organizing effort been?
Well, half of this country, which is well acquainted with incarceration, black, brown, and poor whites, and indigenous descended folks, have an acquaintanceship with prison life and how communication's happening. So essentially, we're speaking on behalf of all those who don't know how it goes down inside. And where there is a will, there is a way. Within prisons, there is a communication network, no matter what. Sometimes to restrict communication between prisoners, they have to create special units called CMUs. Or SHUs, shoes, or communications management units, in order to cut off communication. Kites, which are small notes that are passed prisoner to prisoner, cell to cell, even make their ways into solitary. Some prisons have within certain internal organizations or street organizations, have their own bulletins that make the rounds between every member that are kited to one another. Visitations, are also a form of communication, legal visits, phone calls, newspapers. Basically, where there's a will, there's a way.
And tell us about the demands that are being made.
The demands are the product of negotiation between a number of inside prisoner organizations formed in conference. There's essentially a group, a number of demands numbering over 30 were initially proposed. These were whittled down to like what were felt to be the most essential and common amongst all their different, you know, situations in different facilities and states. They spring essentially from a bid for rehumanization. Every demand at its core is essentially a demand for humanity, for recognition, for rights thereof. They essentially combat the form of living death that they've been abandoned to. They range from the right to vote, demand number 7, you know, to be counted, to demand number 2, wanting fair wage, prevailing wage for all labor, to concrete proposals for policy change on the federal level with the PLRA, the Prison Litigation Reform Act, or as well this Truth in Sentencing Act, which essentially doomed many prisoners to no hope, to what's called Buck Rogers sentences, where even though their state might have outlawed life without parole, their sentences might number in the hundreds of years. An end to racist gang enhancement laws, essentially an additional tool the state granted itself in demonizing and controlling whole populations. That is a triumvirate, basically, of policies from gang injunctions, which are local methods of criminalizing whole neighborhoods and social relationships, where people are forbidden from even socializing with each other, to gang enhancement laws, where if you're deemed to be a relative or as an associate or basically of any organization on the street that doesn't cooperate with the state, you're deemed to be the member of a gang. To gang validation on the inside, the third measure, by which they extend this demonization and oppressive tool to within prisons. So the demands essentially represent a coalition of prisoner groups and their interests in a range of politics, but essentially none of these are new demands. They've all been taken up in one form or another by different groups on the outside, but here they're a condensed package and backed by the force of a national prison strike.
And how do the outside groups that are backing up the strike interact with one another?
Well, we have the luxury of emails, of conference calls, of association. So the challenges for us communicating on this side are fairly basic and conquerable compared to the challenges on the inside. But simplifying this matter is the fact that many groups on the outside do not work with prisoners directly. You know, they take on different pieces of the puzzle, perhaps policy, perhaps reentry or education, or take on one slice of the prison industrial complex. IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, the network to which I'm a member, is one of the few that focuses near exclusively on prisoner membership, as well as aiding prisoners collectively organizing on the inside. Many organizations depend for their programs, which are incredibly helpful and part of a survival program for many prisoners, depend upon the approval of state systems in order to gain access to groups of prisoners inside. So they can't really be seen to be engaging with prisoners in this kind of illegalized and repressed activity. So the number of groups actually doing this work on the inside are very few. And when you do the work for years, as we have been doing, essentially it's a small family. We all know each other.
Now, it was announced that the strike would take place in at least at prisons in at least 17 states. How has it turned out so far?
Well, every day we get reports of activity in more locations. We're being very careful in only updating and broadcasting the instances which we can confirm. But right now, we have confirmed activity in 11 states and one Canadian province. There are more people in facilities sending us reports of their activity, but we're essentially trying to confirm those and fact check ourselves. So it's already showing more activity than the 2016 strike, which eventually involved 11 states and 27 facilities. We were already at that number. And 2016's numbers were accumulated and verified over a period of months. Once lockdowns are lifted, once more correspondence flows, once the initial strike period passes, we'll be able to collect even more information and give an update. But already the activity is wider, the outside support is wider, and the breadth of tactics and involvement is wider.
Now, you use the word activity because there are a number of ways that prisoners can go on strike.
Yes. 2016 essentially called for a work stoppage, but many prisoners do not have a job. So the tactics this time around involve, we're essentially trying to offer avenues of activity or resistance for prisoners in all situations. Some prisoners might be in a wheelchair, might not be allowed to have a job, might be in solitary, so they have no movements to refuse, no opportunity for a sit-in. So they might hunger strike. Many prisoners might be imprisoned in a state where repression is apocalyptic and instant, where simply the risk of retaliation is so high they can't engage in a work stoppage or a sit-down. So they're boycotting. They're withdrawing the money from the corporate vendors that exploit them. So the activity looks quite varied. We have right now 62 people engaged in a hunger strike in an ICE detention facility in Tacoma, all the way down to a solitary figure inside New Folsom engaged in a hunger strike, Heriberto Sharkey Garcia, who's now been hunger striking for 9 days. So there's a whole breadth of activity. Not all of it is immediately visible to the mainstream press, who is not used to covering prison resistance or prisons at all. So essentially the expectations from the mainstream press were for something like the movies, something across between Norma Rae and American Me. They expected wholesale insurrection. So are actually a little disappointed when they have to face kind of the non-spectacular forms of resistance that are nonetheless effective and movement building in and of themselves.
Well, do they pay enough attention even to be disappointed?
In the moment they are. Like, they will not be disappointed in a week when their attention goes back to celebrities and whatever Trump said, in some demented state.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.